previously on the seventh day.
The progress of research in history, archaeology, ancient languages, and anthropology has yielded information that has been hidden for many centuries. And this provides us with important new insights into the meaning of our lives.
Some supercalculating intellect must have designed the properties of the carbon atom. Otherwise, the chance of my finding such an atom through the blind forces of nature would be utterly minuscule.
Darwin's observations and conclusions would revolutionize the conventional view of origins. Now, perhaps some of us have been too quick to discard this old book as an irrelevant collection of useless fables and legends, traditions.
He warned the people that their city was to be destroyed, their temple destroyed, and that they would be carried away to Babylon to serve the king of Babylon. 70 years. Nobody listened.
And they burnt them as they were in the caves, because they were not willing to break in upon the honor they owed the Sabbath, even in such distresses.
By healing the man with the withered hand, Jesus showed the true spirit of the Sabbath. He rejected the rabbi's rules. He kept the Sabbath as taught in the ancient Hebrew scriptures. Titus laid siege to the city, and finally in 70 AD, the Roman army broke through the defenses, ravaged the city, and completely destroyed the temple.
And now, part four of the seventh day, revelations from the lost pages of history.
About 95 or 100 A.D., a change was made in the synagogue service. The middle part of the service is known as the standing prayer, the Amidah, or the 18 benedictions, consisting of 18 short prayers or blessings of God, Thanksgiving blessings. All 18 are recited on weekdays, on Sabbaths only 7. But at this time, an additional one was added. It's known in Hebrew as the Birkat Hamanim, the blessing concerning the heretics, but it's not really a blessing.
May the apostates have no hope. May the dominion of wickedness be speedily uprooted in our day. May the Nazarenes and the heretics quickly perish and not be inscribed together with the righteous. Blessed art thou, the eternal our God, who crushes the wicked.
It smoked out the Christians, because anyone could be asked to lead out in the recitation of this. Anybody, or everybody was supposed to say amen at the end of each one. And this made it very uncomfortable, in fact, impossible for Christians to participate in the Pharisee-led synagogue service from that time onward.
The evidence of this synagogue prayer helped sharpen our picture of first century Christians. It's clear that they were keeping the Sabbath right along with their Jewish brothers. So now the Jews were becoming less tolerant of Christians. But Christians themselves were beginning to question the value of their connection to Judaism.
In the early church literature, Christians are really desperate to separate from Judaism and to distinguish themselves. As a result, there is the appearance of a great deal of anti-Judaism or anti-Semitism. Some of it is invective, nasty comments about Jews. Some of it is pushing away from what they saw as Old Testament religion.
There were practical reasons for the Christians to distance themselves from the Jews. No doubt they were swept up in the current of anti-Jewish sentiment, not surprising given the level of conflict between Jews and the Roman Empire at the time.
Although the Jews were scattered throughout the Mediterranean region and beyond, many of them still dreamed of a great Jewish nation and ultimate victory over their enemies.
And in North Africa, around 115 AD, these dreams flared into violence.
The Jews in the region of Cyrene had put a certain Andreas at their head and were destroying both the Romans and the Greeks. Many they sawed in two from the head downwards. Others they gave to the wild beasts, and still others they forced to fight as gladiators. In all, 220,000 persons perished. In Egypt, too, they perpetrated many similar outrages. And in Cyprus, Dio Cassius.
A few years later, in 132, Jewish opposition to imperial authority exploded into another violent revolt. This time, it was in Jerusalem.
The leader of the Jews at this time was a man by the name of Bar Kokhba, which signifies a star, who possessed the character of a robber and a murderer. But nevertheless, relying upon his name, boasted to them as if they were slaves that he possessed wonderful powers. And he pretended that he was a star that had come down to them out of the heaven to bring them light in the midst of their misfortunes.
Our ancient sources give us two reasons for the Bar Kokhba uprising. First, a prohibition by the Roman Emperor Hadrian, a prohibition against circumcision. Jews would no longer be allowed to practice circumcision. Second, the decision by the Emperor Hadrian to rebuild Jerusalem as a pagan city, the city of Aelia Capitolina.
Imperial forces finally crushed the rebellion in 135. Hadrian banned Jews from Jerusalem and prohibited Sabbath keeping and other Jewish rites of religion.
So there was strong anti-Jewish sentiment throughout the Roman Empire. Jews were the enemy. Christians didn't want to be associated with the Jews and thought of as the enemy. And the easy way to disassociate themselves was to renounce the Sabbath, which was a mark of Jewishness.
So where and when did Christians first begin to observe an alternate day of worship? The lost pages of history lead us in a surprising direction. Alexandria, Egypt. Founded in 332 BC by Alexander the Great, one of the world's great centers of literature, science, and commerce, a melting pot of religious ideas and classical philosophy. There is solid evidence that Christians in Alexandria were the first to replace Sabbath observance with first day, that is, Sunday, worship. This began shortly before 120 AD.
One of the first documents that we find pointing to Christian keeping of Sunday is the so-called Epistle of Barnabas. Now, it is not the real Barnabas that we read about in the New Testament in the book of Acts. This is pseudo-Barnabas. It's a pseudepigraphon. It's falsely attributed to him. But it was written apparently by somebody in Alexandria in Egypt, where the tendency was to spiritualize everything. And that's what this Epistle of Barnabas does. It doesn't take anything literally.
Barnabas believes that the Hebrew Scriptures is a gift to those who truly understand it. But he thinks the ones who understand it will not take it literally, but will understand it in a metaphorical or spiritual sense.
And he rested on the seventh day. This meaneth, when his Son, coming again, shall destroy the time of the wicked man, and judge the ungodly, and change the sun and the moon and the stars, then shall he truly rest on the seventh day.
Barnabas claims that he and his followers are observing the eighth day of the week, the day after the Sabbath, obviously Sunday. He condemns Judaism and everything associated with it, including observance of the seventh-day Sabbath.
The Barnabas letter is the first evidence of Sunday being promoted as the Christian day of worship. But to find the real heart of the pro-Sunday movement, we have to shift our focus from Alexandria westward to the heart of the Roman Empire. It is in ancient Rome that we find the first description of early Christian Sunday keeping. It comes from Justin Martyr, a convert to the new faith.
But Sunday is the day on which we all hold our common assembly, because it is the first day on which God, having wrought a change in the darkness and matter, made the world. And Jesus Christ, our Savior, on the same day, rose from the dead.
early Christian Sunday keepers needed a theological justification for keeping the first day of the week, and they found it in linking the first day to the first day of creation. In doing that, they were denying the authority of Christ, who declared himself to be Lord of the Sabbath, the seventh day of creation week.
For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it.
We have reached a critical defining moment in our story. By isolating the weekly holy day from its biblical roots, church leaders cut off the Sabbath from its source of spiritual meaning. It would become a hollow formality, a political hot potato, a test of authority, and a pawn in a centuries-long power struggle.
Sunday was an attractive replacement for Sabbath because Sunday was beginning to draw to itself a certain amount of aura because of new developments in the pagan religion that made Sunday the day of worshiping the sun and thinking of the sun.
I suppose it was inevitable that elements of pagan worship would find their way into Christianity. Christians were, after all, a small minority in a distinctly pagan world, a world that worshiped mythical gods, dead emperors, and the invincible sun.
Historians commonly date the beginning of the Roman Empire as 31 BC. That's when Octavian defeated the forces of Antony and Cleopatra and came back to Rome to rule as the first Caesar, Caesar Augustus. And it was at that time that he shipped back to Rome two great obelisks.
One of those he set up in the Circus Maximus. You know, it was not only that it was dedicated to the sun god, but it was also a very visible sign that Rome had conquered Egypt, that the dedication on it said, Caesar Augustus dedicates this as a gift to the sun, but it also says, because Egypt has been conquered. And so the people who came to the Circus Maximus to watch the games could see not only this dedication to the sun, but also the realization that the Roman sun god had prevailed over the Egyptian sun god.
Reports from the mid-first century provide additional evidence of the popularity of sun worship. The notorious Emperor Nero commissioned a sculptor to create a statue nearly 115 feet tall, topped with a likeness of his own head in the style of the sun god.
When Vespasian built his great amphitheater, which we call today the Colosseum, he took that enormous colossus, colossus is the ancient word for statue, that enormous colossus of Nero, changed the features on the face, and dedicated it to the sun god.
Emperor Elagabalus was so devoted to his eastern sun god that he took the deity's name. He brought his god in the form of a black meteorite all the way from Syria to Rome, and adopted an Eastern lifestyle.
The sun was worshipped at Emesa under the name Elagabalus and under the form of a black conical stone, which, as it was universally believed, had fallen from heaven on that sacred place. In a solemn procession through the streets of Rome, the way was strewn with gold dust. The black stone, set in precious gems, was placed in a chariot drawn by 6 milk-white horses. The pious emperor held the reins. Elagabalus, corrupted by his youth, his country, his fortune, abandoned himself to the grossest pleasures with ungoverned fury.
And so his Eastern dress and his Eastern orgies and his Eastern behavior brought Elagabalus to grief after 4 years. And even though his god was sent back, the black stone was shipped back to Syria, that sun worship continued.
The ancient historian Plutarch reports how the Roman general Pompey went to the Eastern Mediterranean to deal with a problem of pirates attacking commercial shipping. This is about 50 BC. Well, he conquered the pirates, captured them, brought them back to Rome. Turns out the pirates were worshippers of Mithras, the sun god. And from those pirates, the worship of Mithras became very popular in Rome, especially among the military.
I think that Roman military men would find Mithras a particularly attractive divinity. He was a warrior himself, fighting for the forces of good. It was a hierarchical religion. And one could progress from grade to grade. There were 7 grades of Mithraism, much like in an army. And thirdly, it was a religion of brotherhood and fellowship. They would meet together not only to worship their god, but to eat a meal in common. We hear about Roman soldiers having come back from the east who pray at dawn, facing the east, facing the sun. And this is when we begin to get in Rome a mention of Deus Sol Invictus. That is to say, the unconquerable sun god. Unconquerable because the night tries to conquer the sun in each 24-hour period. But at dawn, the sun has survived. The sun has vanquished the night.
The importance of sun-worshipping cults in the Roman Empire is shown during the reign of Aurelian, who was emperor from 270 to 275 AD. He established a state religion that included the worship of both the emperor and Sol Invictus, the invincible sun. He tried to unify all religions under the sun god. Diocletian, who came to power in 284, was also devoted to the sun god. He maintained Aurelian's principle of a state religion and even declared himself to be a god. Eventually, he ordered the persecution of Christians.
To some Christian leaders, it made sense to take advantage of the popularity of Sunday, especially since Sunday observance would make Christianity more attractive to the pagans, who already worshiped the sun on that day. For example, the Roman Emperor Constantine was, like Aurelian and Diocletian before him, a worshiper of the sun. He was the first emperor to profess belief in Christianity. It was during a crusade against his rivals that he was supposedly converted to Christianity. Sympathetic biographers claim that before a climactic battle near Rome, Constantine saw a vision of a flaming cross in the sky. He credited this vision with his subsequent victory and declared himself to be a Christian. Historians debate whether or not Constantine's conversion was genuine, since he maintained his pagan superstitions throughout much of his reign. He consented to baptism only as he lay on his deathbed. Still, his reign did mark a dramatic turning point in the history of Christianity. In 313, with the agreement of his co-emperor Licinius, he effectively legalized the Christian religion.
The reign of Constantine the Great forms one of the epochs in the history of the world. It is the era of the dissolution of the Roman Empire, the commencement, or rather consolidation, of a kind of Eastern despotism with a new capital, a new constitution, and finally, a new religion.
Was Constantine converted to Christianity, or was it the other way around? Who knows? But what's important to us today is that what emerged was a different kind of church, a different kind of state. In fact, the two were so blended together, it was hard to see where one ended and the other began.
It seems that Constantine's personal religion was a mixture of Mithraic sun worship and Christianity. According to his Christian biographer, Eusebius, he taught all his armies to zealously honor the Lord's Day, Sunday, referring to it as the day of light and of the sun. Distinctly pagan terminology. Take a look at this passage from his famous Sunday Law of AD 321.
On the venerable day of the sun, let the magistrates and people residing in cities rest, and let all workshops be closed. In the country, however, persons engaged in agriculture may freely and lawfully continue their pursuits.
The first law requiring people to celebrate on Sunday and rest on Sunday was a law promulgated by the Emperor Constantine in the year 321. And he does it without any reference to Christian theology or Christian ideas. He says to abstain from labor on the venerable day of the sun, which is an allusion to the fact that the sun was becoming more and more the object of worship. So the first Sunday law requiring people to keep Sunday had no Christian flavor at all.
Although Constantine promoted Christianity and built many, many Christian churches, he closed very few pagan temples. And we have a Roman calendar from the year 354. That's about 17 years after the death of Constantine, which has four separate festivals each year to the sun god. It shows that the sun god survived not only Constantine, but into the reigns of his immediate successors.
Did Constantine's Sunday law settle the Saturday-Sunday issue? Not according to the records from the ancient city of Laodicea, where church leaders met near the middle of the 4th century.
The church council at Laodicea dealt specifically with the issue of what scriptures, if any, should be read at Sabbath services.
The Gospels are to be read on the Sabbath, that is, Saturday, with the other scriptures.
The fact that the council addressed this issue is irrefutable proof that Christian church members were still attending worship services on the seventh-day Sabbath. Remember, this is more than 300 years after Christ. But there's more.
Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath, but must work on that day, rather honoring the Lord's day. And if they can, resting then as Christians. But if any shall be found to be Judaizers, let them be anathema from Christ.
What did the council mean by Judaizers? Judaizers were those Christians who did not work on Sabbath, like the Jews. Church leaders wanted everyone to work on Sabbath and to refrain from work on the first day of the week, which they now called the Lord's Day. And this was consistent with the Sunday law enacted by the Emperor Constantine.
In spite of the popularity of sun worship and the Sunday laws of emperors, many Christians continued to worship on the seventh-day Sabbath. In fact, Christian churches that abandoned the Sabbath were in the minority.
For although almost all churches throughout the world celebrate the sacred mysteries on the Sabbath of every week, yet the Christians of Alexandria and at Rome, on account of some ancient tradition, have ceased to do this.
Without question, Christians were still observing the seventh-day Sabbath clear down in the second half of the 4th century. In spite of theological arguments, anti-Jewish prejudice, and the decree of an emperor, the Sabbath of the Creator was not dead. The succeeding centuries saw the Sabbath at the heart of controversy between popes and patriarchs. The weekly day of rest and worship became a test of church authority and a sign of submission to the sovereignty of a new kind of religious government. It became a major cause of the great rift that divided the Christian church for 900 years.
Next time on the seventh day...
I am Patrick, a sinner most unlearned, the least of all the faithful, and utterly despised by many.
Then I took to flight, and I left the man with whom I had stayed for 6 years.
Columba and his fellow missionaries firmly planted the Christian religion in Scotland. Their converts resisted the growing influence of Rome, which promoted Sunday as the day of worship.
When Margaret first came to Scotland, she was dissatisfied with Sunday observance as she found it. She found that lay people tended to carry on their menial labors on Sunday.
The Sabbath, the Sunday change, became a mark of Roman Catholic or papal authority.
Marcion wanted to discredit the Sabbath because it was an image of creation. For him, creation was an evil deed of an evil God, the God of the Old Testament.
In 602, Pope Gregory identified Sabbath keepers with the Antichrist. He called them Judaizers because of their determination to observe the seventh day as a day for rest and worship.
Sabbath was a day of feasting. In fact, to fast on the Sabbath meant to break the Sabbath. And so this was another way of distancing Christianity from Judaism.